Committee on Judiciary, June 21st, 1977, Room 350, 8:15 a.m., work session on Senate Bill 718.
Here we come to order. This is the committee's work session on Senate Bill 718. A number of amendments have been prepared, and I'm going to ask Representative Lombard to take the committee through those. I'd like to ask if there could be a representative from at least two of the points of view on the bill that might come up to the table here and be available for questions. I suppose Mr. Fender and Mr. Crawford, you might be one of them, and Mr. Wheatley, whoever you'd like, why don't you come up here. Do all the members of the committee have the Legislative Council 62077 amendments in front of them? Okay, Representative Lombard.
Okay, well, after the initial hearing on the bill, I think a number of us were very concerned about the direction that the bill was going, and particularly as it related to what I would call certain interferences with rights of contract. And also, it seemed very apparent to me that one of the areas in which a great many of the witnesses were making their complaints was in the area of third-party claims that weren't even addressed in the bill in any way, and so consequently the bill really did nothing to or for them, other than perhaps under Section 4. And you know, I really wasn't too happy with the direction of the bill, the way it was, the way it was directed. And so, what the proposed amendments, attempt to do, and I just got a copy of these last night, and so I haven't had a chance to really thoroughly look at them. So I think it behooves us to look at them and discuss them. But I think generally, they attempt to take more of a disclosure approach rather than trying to get into the contract itself, although there's still maybe some questions in one section of the bill. In any event, the first suggested amendment would add a definition for an adjuster in the definitions section of the bill, and quite frankly, I haven't looked at the cross. Haven't had the time to look at the cross references here, but I don't know, Mr. Fender. Maybe you can clarify this. The adjuster definition merely refers to 2 ORS chapters 744.505 and 744.515. And do I assume correctly that those provisions describe the adjuster or the role of the adjuster?
Yes, Representative Lombard, there are two different provisions. One is for the independent adjuster and the other is for the adjuster who is an employee of an insurer. And they're treated separately. An independent adjuster has to be licensed and a company employee does not under the current law.
Okay. What I thought I'd do is just run through the bill and then I think come back, Mr. Chairman, because I think we are going to probably have to dwell a little bit on some of the specific sections here.
Can I ask a question before you begin,
yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Can I ask?
Says adjuster in the amended, this marked up version. Can an adjuster be an employee of an insurance company?
Yes. I think it's intended to be.
Okay, but maybe I'm putting it wrongly. Can this deal of appearing right on the scene, making the estimate, maybe I should say an estimator for the adjustment cost, can he be the person who might also sell and service the policy?
I don't know. In other words,
under 744.
In other words, you take the small, say the small town agent that may be given authority by his company to
estimate damage
or pay loss claim.
And write the check right there while the guy's, while his radiator is leaking on the pavement.
I can't honestly say. Because, as I say, I'm not really familiar with these provisions. There is some changes in the existing definitions, not major changes, but some language changes in the definition of motor vehicle liability insurance policy, and also in motor vehicle body and frame repair shop. The next section that where there are some significant changes, and I think we should come back to, is in section 3. First of all, in section 3 sub 1, this is the provision that would prohibit an insurer from requiring that a specific person or specific body shop make repairs to a vehicle as a condition of recovery. And the amendments would also put a third-party claimant in the same position as the insured, that is that the insurer, the insurance company, could not direct and control either the insured or the third-party claimant. I want to come back to that because I think I may still have a concern on this, but I think that's something we should come back to. Sub 2 of Section 3 is a section that, in its original form, prohibited the insurer from recommending to the insured the repairs be made at a particular place or by a particular person. It would expand that prohibition to also third-party claims, except that it would accept out unless it's requested to make that recommendation. So it would allow the recommendation to be made where requested by the third-party claimant or the insured. Section 3...
Excuse me, I misunderstood you. You said you were going to amend out the requested...
No, that would be added. That would be added.
As it is in the draft here in front of us, right?
Well, I don't know what draft you're...
Well, I'm looking at the same one.
That's an engrossed version, which I assume
includes
these
engrossed. Okay, but I'm looking at the engrossed.
Okay. I don't think any substantive change to sub 3 of section 3, but then there would be a new sub 4, which provides that no insurer shall contract for its insureds or a third-party claimant's repairs with any motor vehicle body and frame repair shop if it's controlling ownership of the insurer and the motor vehicle body and frame repair shop is held by the same holding company or corporation. I take that to be more of an extension of sub 3, with regards to an integrated company, I guess it doesn't really even, it's just a related through controlling ownership.
That means then, if I understand it correctly, that a guy with an Allstate policy gets in an accident over on Union Avenue right in front of the Sears repair shop, he can't be directed to go in there. No matter where
he gets. If Sears has a body shop,
let's assume they do. I don't know what they do.
Sears. Well, that may be what that does. Yeah, I think
it seems very clear that he can't go in there.
Yeah.
And also that Allstate or Sears cannot own any repair shops.
Well, that's
where their Allstate works.
That's under sub 3, I think.
Do you have a copy of the Linmark Associates case? Mr. Wheeler, is this your memo, procedural and substantive problems? Is that your memo?
Yes, I do.
Do you have a copy of the Linmark case?
Yeah.
contract for. I think what it's bothering me, Kip, is this. It shall not contract for a third-party claimant's repair where they own it. Let's take the same set of facts that I just imagined, and the, let's assume the owner, let's say I'm the owner of the policy from Allstate, I don't want my car repaired there for a long time. I prefer to go right there. This would seem to preclude
the prohibition here right now is that the insurer shall not contract.
That means he shall not, in the body of the policy, insist that you go to a firm which he owns or controls? Or does it mean under no circumstance can that Allstate-insured automobile be repaired in such a place?
I don't read it as saying under no circumstance, but I think that's something we should come back to.
In other words, he cannot, in the policy, for instance, say, you must get this repaired at a at a shop, which we say, or own, which we own. Roy number four says, or control.
Let's come back to that, because I think, again, that's something that I'd just as soon have Mr. Fender discuss in greater depth. Under Section 4, there's a deletion on page 2 of the word passenger in the last line, and then there's the deletion of the last sentence on at the top of page 3. And I think it was the intent of the auto body people on this one that the sign not be misleading as to suggest that they to not mislead the insurer into believing that he can have his car repaired at any location. Now the Section 5 in the original bill, the violations thing, which was originally said as a Class C misdemeanor, is just said as a $100 violation, a maximum $100 fine violation. Mark?
That's for better.
Yeah, that's for failure to post the sign.
Failure to post the sign, yeah. Section 5, in its original form, is deleted in its entirety. And a Section 5 is proposed that would basically require disclosure by the adjuster establishing a proof of loss. And this would be so both for claims by insureds and claims by third party claimants. It would also require that insurance policies issued after the effective date of the act likewise contain a disclosure of the rights and responsibilities of the insured, actually under the policy when a claim is submitted. You recall that one of the things that was submitted in evidence at the time of the hearing was the State Farm auto damage claim policy that set out really in layman's language what the rights of the insured, their insureds were in making claims. And would also require disclosure of the provisions of subsections 1 and 2 of section 3. The penalty provision under section 7 would likewise reduce the penalty from a Class C misdemeanor to a fine of a maximum $100. Now, I've got some questions in section 6 likewise, but I think that's basically those are some of the changes that are being proposed. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that we go back, probably, and walk through it section by section and have a commentary by the witnesses.
Sir Gardner.
What's the policy underlying both the civil penalty in Section 6 and, I suppose, well, another civil penalty in Section 7? Do we really need both, in your opinion, Kip?
Well, in my own opinion, I'm not sure that we do, no. Why don't you ask the proponents of the bill, though?
Why don't we hold that for a moment until we get back to that point in the bill? The first proposed amendment is to add a definition of adjuster. Now, mindful of the fact that we are having a House session starting at 9:30, and this committee will work on as far as it can, but some of us have to be on the floor this morning. Basically, a very important session. I'd like to ask you to confine your remarks to as succinct a response as you can. If you agree with the amendment, that's all you need to tell us. If you disagree, then go ahead and tell us why. Now, is there any problem with the definition of adjuster as it's proposed to be added to the bill?
Well, for my part, I haven't had an opportunity to read those two sections that's referred to, but if they do include both the independent adjuster and the company adjuster, I suppose it would be accurate.
All right, I take it from your comment that the principal problem you would want the committee to be alert to is to assure that any definition would embrace both adjusters directly employed by an insurer and those who act independently.
That's correct.
Line 10, the word passenger is deleted. Any comment on that amendment? In line 19, the word collision is replaced by the word physically.
Do you have a copy? Wouldn't it be easier, Mr. Chairman, to have a copy of this marked up bill like this?
They have one, don't they?
They have one?
Yeah, they're working right through it. Let me ask preliminarily further. How much chance have you had to review the amendments, Mr. Wheeler?
About 10 minutes. I just got it this morning.
All right. Well, for the moment, I'll pose my questions on the basis of your present impression, and if you have further thoughts later, you can get them back to us. In Section 3, the provisions would be extended in subsection 1 to apply to both insureds, direct insureds, and third-party claimants.
Well, I do have some comments about that. I think at the last hearing, Representative Lombard pointed out several times that many of the complaints that the individuals had related to a third-party tort claim instead of a contractual right. And to me, that really reflected the fact that the basic underlying problem here is not a contractual one between an insured and the insurance company, but is really a problem between the party who owns the car, regardless of who he is, whether he's insured, whether he's not, whether he's a third-party claimant or whatever, somebody that wants, as a consumer, wants his car repaired, and one garage or the other is not doing a good job. Now, it seems to me to be that this bill is made even worse by trying to include in a law that is basically involving contract law between the insured and the insurance company, tort law, You say, for instance, in Section 3, or I don't mean you say, but this proposed amendment would say, that the insurance company could not go to a third-party claimant and say, my insurer just hit your car, ran through a red light and hit your car. I'm not going to tell you where to take your car. I'm not going to make any recommendation. He can't anyway. If the third-party claimant comes up to the insurance company and says, I'm not even going to repair my car. I've got about $500 worth of damage to it. You'd like me to take it down and be repaired? I'm not going to do it. I want my $500. He's entitled to the difference in market value before and after. He doesn't have to go to any repair shop in the world. And to say that an insurance company cannot tell a claimant that he must go to this repair shop or I will not recommend the repair shop to you is accurate enough because it would be like saying you cannot go out and shoot your mother or something. It's just a meaningless inclusion in this law, and I think that it only adds confusion and does tend to cover up what is the underlying problem, as I see it, which really isn't between the relationship of the insurance company and their own policyholders, but it is between the consumer who wants his car repaired and some garage which, for one reason or another, doesn't do a satisfactory job. But I think there would be some real problems if you try to bring in to a bill, which is a contractual one between the insured and the insurance company, some language that is going to tell the insurance company how they are to relate to a third-party claimant with whom they have absolutely
Mr.
no
Chairman,
contractual obligation.
It's a superfluous reference, apparently, to your relationship with the third party, but is it harmful?
Well, to put something in the law which
you don't like.
Well, I suppose that that when you pass a law saying that an insurance company can't say something, there are the reasons that I don't like it, can't say something to a third-party claimant in which they don't have any legal obligation
anyway
to do anyway, and the other party doesn't have any legal obligation or contractual obligation to respond to, I think, and then you attach to it certain penalties, such as punitive damages that will arise to the injured party, you're really opening a door. I go up as an insurance company, I tell some third-party claimant, well, I'm sorry that my insured hit your car in the intersection, we'd really like to get it repaired, and they say, well, I really need my car, and they say, well, why don't you take it over to so-and-so's garage? They do pretty fast work, and we'll get you right in, right out. Suddenly, you're sued for punitive damages now under Section 6
section
or 7
six,
or
yeah.
Whatever the section was, because you have referred this person to another garage when he doesn't have any obligation to go to it anyway, but under this law, he is liable then.
I'm not leaving
Mr. Chairman, might I respond to those comments?
Mr. Fender?
I think what we're talking about here is we're talking about business practices. And it isn't necessarily such a great issue as to whether those business practices arise out of a contract or whether they arise out of a third-party claim. And in both occasions, the need for this provision arises. The section as drafted does not restrict an insurer's right to negotiate. It does not restrict his right to offer cash in lieu of repairs. But it does provide some equality of bargaining power between a little insured and a giant insurance company. And I think that's really what we're talking about, because there are recriminations that could take place in these negotiations down the road. How fast the man gets his car repaired, or whether he has a prompt settlement or not. The power of cancellation. All of these are factors that can tacitly or by inference enter into the negotiation regarding the repair of the automobile. And while it might be nice to say that the section is ineffective and there's an exposure to liability, I frankly just can't agree with that.
Are you speaking now to the third-party claimant?
Both. I mean, the business practice applies to both third-party claimants and insureds alike.
All right, I just want to clarify that.
And when we took another look at the bill after the first hearing and realized that there was a big void in terms of the third-party practice area, we tried to come up with language that would not interfere with the traditional rights of an insurance carrier to settle that claim for the lowest dollar figure possible without violating the rights of a third-party claimant or an insured through some type of coercive tactic. And simply, Section 3 speaks to that, and I might like to elaborate just for a second, because many times people don't want their car fixed at all. They're very unhappy with it after it's been involved in a collision. And from a consumer satisfaction point of view, having the right to take that car that your wife and children are going to ride in to someone that you feel confident of with in terms of repairing it is pretty darned important. And when a large company uses its leverage to move someone to a point where they don't want to go, I think we then start to talk about a consumer protection concept and not an interference with a contract right, because the consumer protection overrides any minor interference with contract rights.
Representative Gardner?
I think your point probably has some validity as far as the insured goes, because basically he might be in a situation where even through the contractual process of getting the policy of insurance, he's not bargaining as an equal with the insurance company. But as far as the third-party claimant, I think I don't think I can agree with you at all, because basically he has a remedy. Well, first of all, there isn't any relationship with him. He just happens to come into the thing through a tort action, and he's in a position where one of the items in negotiation may very well be that the car be repaired at the insurance company's place that they want to have it done. He isn't as coerced as the insured is, because he has the remedy basically of a lawsuit for the recovery of the difference in market value before and after as an alternative. I can make a distinction between those two.
Well, Representative Gardner, I think the problem is that in the meantime, the guy walks. And what you're talking about is how rapidly the claim is settled. The insurer generally approaches, as a third-party claimant, the carrier in the interest of settling the claim as quickly as possible. Sure. Because he would like to no longer be a pedestrian and have his car repaired. And he'd like to have it repaired in the shortest period of time. Now, if he's only got one car, and he's dealing with an adjuster who has no other business relationship with him, no need to maintain his goodwill, you have a situation, I think, which is very unlike the one that you were describing. And we're trying to address that business consequence of settling these kind of claims in a way that the customer is left satisfied. Now, there's one final comment. There's nothing in this language that we interpret to prevent a carrier from saying, look, we'll settle your claim within 24 hours, we'll do this, we'll do that, but we would like you to take it to our shop. Will you agree to that? If the man agrees to that, he gets his car repaired at their shop. Now,
what about subsection 2? Doesn't that specifically cover that? He can't even recommend under subsection 2 to the third party claimant that it be repaired at that shop.
Unless the man requests it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how's he going to know to request it if he doesn't know that the insurance company has it, and doesn't the insurance company have to raise the issue?
Because under section 5, the adjuster has to make a disclosure as to what the settlement practices are and tell him that he can't direct them, and also tell him that he can't advise him as to a repair shop unless he requests that information. And this third-party claimant would be put on notice under those circumstances.
Let's take the next amendment relating to the conditioning the prohibition, or rather relaxing the prohibition in the case of a request.
You haven't reached that point yet, have you?
No. You're still discussing the third-party claimant issue.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I assume, Mr. Wheatley, you'd be the appropriate person at this point to ask for a response on that.
What if I could make one comment before leaving the last section? I had submitted, or I assume that I've submitted copies of the general objections that we have, to these other provisions, and with regard to the section that we just covered, section...
Is that the three pieces of paper that say procedural and substantive problems,
yes.
Senate Bill 718, and
yes.
Otherwise unidentified?
Right, yes. That's the one. Under 3.2, I only addressed my remarks a few minutes ago to the problems I saw with respect to including that language relating to a third-party claimant, but in general, I just would like to say that I do see a difference between having your car repaired and perhaps going to your family doctor. We have medical provisions, payment provisions in a policy, and I think that it's reasonable that a person would want not only to receive medical attention after an accident, but perhaps would have some confidence in a particular doctor. But with respect to repairs of a garage of an automobile, I really think that what the consumer wants is a result. And to know that John Jones's garage worked on it, although he doesn't know who the employees are, isn't really the important thing to him. He wants his car, when it comes out, regardless of who did it, to have done a good job. And I think that's distinguishable from having your family doctor or somebody else perform personal service. And that, again, is why I think the underlying problem here is not a contractual one or one between the insurance company and the insured, but really relates to the problem with the repair shops themselves, and which is why I think the legislation should be geared towards what California and New York has done to correct the problems with repair shops turning out results that are not satisfactory for the consumer, rather than to direct it in this manner. And getting back to number two, then, the added language really doesn't solve the problem. It seems to me to be, first of all, anomalous to say that when you go to your insurance agent, and maybe you're not a skilled person in having auto accidents and having them repaired, you could be the typical 80-year-old widow or somebody that has never had an accident, that relies on the agent, and to have him be able, or to have him not be able to say, "Now look, Mrs. Jones, your car is damaged. I know you need your car. It's an Oldsmobile. I suggest that you take it over to Dunham Motors here and have it repaired. I know they can get it in and get it out right away." It seems to me to be a poor law to say they can't make that recommendation, and yet the tow truck driver that towed the truck in, the ambulance driver that might have been on the scene, the police officer, the next door neighbor, the grocer can say, "If I were you, I'd take it over to this garage or that garage." All these other people can say it, but not the one person who probably is extremely skilled in knowing how many garages are there in town, which ones have a reputation for getting work out right away, which ones have a reputation for doing good work, which ones can handle that particular type of car. There's probably very few people that would be as skilled as that. The insurance commissioner indicated that in those situations where a recommendation is made, he requires the insurance company then to guarantee the work and to see to it that that garage, if there are any problems, that the insurance company takes it back and does have it done. And finally, with respect to the constitutional question, I really feel now that it is clearly unconstitutional. There was a case that came up down from the Supreme Court last month, the Supreme Court of the United States, which I really didn't have an opportunity to look at until just recently, but for those interested, Representative Myers has my marked copy that I have referred to it in this three-page note. And just briefly, what this case involved was a law in New Jersey where realtors were putting up these normal signs saying, house for sale, call so-and-so realty. The city council decided that by having these house signs up in the community, it was causing kind of a panic sale because people would then get the impression that the blacks were moving in, therefore the whites had better move out right away to sell as fast as you can. And they thought to solve a social problem, they would pass a city ordinance saying that no realtor or no one could put a house sign out saying for sale. And they brought in a lot of statistics and a lot of evidence to show what the overall community effect of panic selling would result from that type of tactic. And the U.S. Supreme Court then simply said, well, we recognize the problem, the social problem. However, the constitutional rights of freedom of speech cannot be subverted in that manner. You are disseminating valuable information, namely that this house is for sale. It is not interfering with anybody's right to the enjoyment of their own property and rights, and so it's simply totally unconstitutional. And they, without going into it in great detail, the language the court used, I think, makes it pretty clear that it would be applicable in this case, because, as they said, the constitutional defect in this ordinance is very basic. The act is designed to prevent its residents from obtaining certain information, information which is of vital interest to the members of the community. And I think to say that a person does not have a constitutional right to say, I personally recommend that garage over there, is constitutionally improper. And finally, the language also just procedurally saying, adding to it as they do here, unless requested to do so, it doesn't indicate by whom the request should be made. Presumably it could be the husband, the next door neighbor, or a friend that calls in and says, well, you, and that should also be corrected if it were to be put in.
Mr. Chairman, might I respond?
Mr. Finner.
I can't see that the case that's been cited really applies here, because we're comparing a total prohibition against a limited restraint. And in the case cited, there was an absolute prohibition against putting up any sign of any kind. And I think what we're talking about here is we're talking about the regulation of business practices that have become anti-competitive, have become sweetheart contracts, present potentials for kickbacks, and we're looking at the question of invoking the police power to abridge the freedom of speech to some degree, and it's a very small degree, because the question that's addressed is simply the carrier must put the customer on notice because the carrier has an economic interest in the settlement of that claim prior to making a recommendation. And we're not saying that he can't talk to the customer. We're simply trying to provide some equality in bargaining power when it's time to pay under that policy.
Mr. Chairman, one additional thing. We also are not prohibiting, under the way this has been written, for those who really feel it's important to maintain that right of recommendation, that they post a sign conspicuously that says, we may recommend a body shop to you if you so request. Really have given them all the latitude in the world, but you and I both know, in all kinds of segments of society, that when somebody who appears in a position of authority, as the insurance man or the adjuster does, and he says, by the way, Mr. Myers, I recommend to you that you take this to Hank Crawford's body shop, the person who's been injured just automatically thinks that that is just one heck of a recommendation, and it indeed is very subtle coercion.
Suppose the insured were to say, the insurer were to say, I can't recommend a particular shop unless you request it.
There certainly would
request it. Is that, would you regard that kind of solicitation of a request a violation of the act as now drafted?
No, sir. I think, Mr. Chairman, that speaks to the issue of putting the consumer on notice that the carrier cannot recommend unless he requests. It raises a red flag in his mind. I do have a choice. And we talked a little bit about there's a difference between choosing a body shop and choosing a doctor. I agree. One is a doctor for your car, and one is a doctor for your body. If your car falls apart, if the suspension component comes off, you die. If your heart stops functioning, you die. The consequence is the same. If your car has been collision damaged, you're going to want the best care for your car, particularly if it involves suspension components. Secondly, the carrier that objects strenuously to this provision is the one that talks the most about their guarantee. Now, within that context, they are offering you an argument that doesn't square. It's anomalous to say that a guarantee isn't important when you offer a guarantee and the question of who fixes it is irrelevant.
Let's go on with sub 3. Now, I think that the position of the different viewpoints that were presented the other night on the question of the restraint imposed by Section 3, I think that's pretty clear to the committee. Are there any positions that are changed as a result of these amendments, proposed amendments?
No, I've set out my objections in the three page, and there's nothing new by this.
Now, subsection 4 is new, and I would assume that the views of each of you with respect to 4 would be analogous to your views on 3.
I think that's correct. I haven't had an opportunity to study 4 that carefully. I would be a little concerned about how it would relate to the credit life policies that you get from the GMAC company, General Motors, when you buy a car, whether or not they, by definition, are an insurer under that situation. And this language would seem to be broad enough to somehow cover that. And if I had more time to study that language,
would you think it might be? Would you give me that again, Bill?
Well, you buy a car from a new Pontiac from the General Motors dealer, and you have an option to get a credit life policy, which is issued by a General Motors subsidiary, which is GMAC. So now we have the car or General Motors acting in the capacity as controlling or having controlling ownership of an insurance company that issued the insurance on your car. And how that would then relate when you wanted to take it back to their...
to a GM dealer.
Yeah. I just haven't studied this language long enough to be able to know how that would all work out in the end, but I would think that there would be some problems there. I'm sure that this language was not intended to include them, but by simply saying no insurer, and I think by definition, though, they would be an insurer here.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see the application of credit life, because this bill deals with motor vehicle liability policies, but with that aside, I think we have to go back to Section 3 and move from Section 3 back to Section 4 to understand what we're trying to do here. ORS 731.450, which is existing insurance law, says that no insurer shall engage in any business except the making of insurance or a kind of business related to the insurance business. Insurance is defined in 731.102 as a contract whereby one undertakes to indemnify another or to pay or allow a specified or ascertainable amount, dollars now, or benefit upon determinable risk contingencies and includes annuities. So what we're really addressing in Section 3 and Section 4 is that prohibition and applying it and updating the law and re-relating it to this particular situation.
Now, is it your view that the relationship that's described in sub 3 is presently prohibited by Oregon law?
It may very well be.
Has that section been judicially construed at all?
Not that I am aware of.
That part of the section dealing with, what's the language? It's not businesses like insurance.
The insurer shall engage in any business except the making of... No insurer shall engage in any business except the making of insurance or a kind of business related to the insurance business.
Related to the insurance business. That's not been judicially applied as far as...
To the best of my knowledge,
it's been
not.
Administratively interpreted to your knowledge in Oregon in any way.
I don't think the case has arisen, to the best of my knowledge. Now, perhaps someone else has an opinion on that.
Do you regard that section as applicable to this kind of situation, Mr. Wheeler?
Well, I think that auto repair is related to the insurance business. And that, of course, is one of the reasons why we're involved with this particular proposed bill. And I think that it definitely is. Now, I haven't had an opportunity, as I say, to study that carefully, but I do feel there's a problem there. Does warrant further study.
Can you give me the citation of that code section?
Yes, Representative Gardner. It's 731.450. In continuation on that, what we attempted to do with Section 4 is apply that across in the case where the insurance company was owned by a holding company. Because there's a problem in terms of business structure to deal with that problem without going back up the ladder and coming down to achieve the intent of 731.450. Now, at our last hearing, there were representations that all of the activity in this area by insurance carriers were experimental. And I think if you take a look in the back of the blue handout that we provided you, you'll find an information sheet on TechCore. And TechCore tells you that they have good news for you. They have three of them. They're soliciting the business of other insurers. They're running an auction. They're processing titles. They're sending other insurance carriers the check. And they're towing. And there are three of them right now. There are none in Oregon, but they do have frame machines and damage appraisal and body reconditioning services. They take care of flood and fire damage. And this was represented as an experiment. And the question really is just how important is the small business sector to Oregon? How important is the consumer choice in having a local businessman that they can go to if they have a grievance instead of writing 85 letters to an obscure corporate headquarters someplace in the United States? We happen to think that the small businessman is pretty darned important. And we think that this vertical integration, whatever form it may take, is a question that you might address in this legislation, because there certainly is a trend to go this way.
Section 4, the reference to passenger motor vehicle, which I assume, aside from the policy question of the whole section, I assume is no problem. The second sentence, you have a right to have your automobile repaired at the shop of your choice, is also deleted. Representative Lombard, what was your thinking there?
On the deletion of the "you have a right to have your automobile repaired," I think the proponents of the bill's intent here, or desire here, was to try to remove any suggestion in this sign language that that the insured or claimant can have his automobile repaired at any facility and then require that the insurer pay the cost. In other words, I think it follows upon some of the testimony the other night that I think most of the witnesses agreed that the insurance company retained some right to control the reasonableness of the repair expenses, and it was the feeling of some of the parties that this language would mislead the insured or the claimant to believe that that he could go in and get his car repaired at whatever cost and the company would be liable. I don't have really any opinion as to whether that this would accomplish that or not. But
Chairman, from our, what is the case law now with respect to a person who sues his or her insurer or a third-party insurer about the value of the repairs that the insurance company is obligated to pay for? It sticks in my mind if there's a case that says the insurance company must pay a, quote, commercially reasonable rate. Is that correct? Bill, do you or Tom know?
Yes, that is correct, Representative Frohnmayer. The carrier is only responsible for the reasonable cost of repair, and most policies read that way.
But that might be more than the insurer, in fact, offers in any given instance.
That could be the case, or less.
Yeah, okay. If you were to take your car to a body shop, let's say, paid $2 an hour more than the prevailing wage rate, and hence had a total repair cost of $15, $20, $30 over what the insurance company usually paid, you suppose the court would hold for the plaintiff there and say that, irrespective of the fact that it was $10, $20, $30, $40 more, that it was still commercially reasonable?
It would be my opinion that it be a question of fact as to whether that was commercially reasonable or not, and I think you could have cases going either way. But I have with me a United Pacific Reliance policy, and the language used here is the limit of the company's liability for loss shall not exceed the actual cash value of the property, or if the loss is a part thereof, the actual cash value of such part at the time of loss, nor what it would then cost to repair or replace the property or such part. In other words, the reasonable cost of repair, it all boils down to that.
Okay, but then looking at the boldface language that you want on the sign, isn't really the issue that the insurance policy can or should pay for reasonable cost of repairs rather than necessarily saying at the body shop of your choice? Or putting it another way, if you said you have the right to have it repaired at any body shop of your choice as long as it is at a commercially reasonable rate.
Well, we would have no objections to the addition of that kind of language. The problem we're trying to address, Representative Frohnmayer, is that many of these shops never even get a chance to see these cars because of the direction and control issue. And by virtue of putting the consumer on notice that the carrier can't do that, the shop has at least an opportunity to be competitive when one carrier has only 10 shops on their list in all of Portland. You know, what happened to the other 200-odd shops? They never saw that car. And that certainly is not open, free competition or free enterprise or anything that like that. And essentially, this bill deals with that issue, and we hope that, you know, these provisions address that adequately.
Let's take a look at the new Section 5.
Question, Mr. Chairman. What do you mean, Tom, by shall advise? Shall advise when and in what manners? On the second line of your new Section 5.
I think in this particular case, Representative Bugis, it could either be oral or written. And it would operate much the same as Truth in Lending does.
Okay, adjuster, Allstate adjuster gets a call his insured says, I'm down at the corner of State and High. I just got embroiled in an accident. The adjuster says, hold it right there. I'll be right down. What does he do? Hand him a printed statement. Now read this first. Or does he advise him first? I want you to know that we hear your rights and responsibilities. You know, I mean, how's it going to work in practice? I can't tell you where to go. I hear your rights under the contract, you know, insurance.
In terms of rights and practice, most people, when the claim is adjusted, if it's done by the two large companies that operate drive-in centers, the insured receives a check. And that check is his satisfaction for that claim. They advertise the fact that we're going to give you a check when you drive out. It could be a printed endorsement on the check. Now, you know, if that is the best way to do business, they have a natural medium upon which to apply that message, that check. I think if it's an independent adjuster, you know, appraising a loss, he could either tell the insured that or provide the insured with a piece of paper that says that.
Mr. Chairman. Tom, I'm looking at subsection 2A of section 5. The statement in clear and conspicuous language of the rights and responsibilities of the insured. Now that could go on 5 or 6 or 7 pages, couldn't it?
Could
you clearly spell out in unambiguous, you know, English language what the law is, stating the rights and responsibilities?
I have a sheet here that State Farm did on one page, and there's the full-page ad that responded to 718. That's the State Farm policy.
Yeah, but I guess my point is you're really asking for a hornbook law on the rights and responsibilities of an insurance company, aren't you? And if they guess wrong, or if they don't pick up the latest case, or if a case comes down afterwards, isn't that just going to be a hell of a mess?
I don't think so, Representative Frohnmayer. The consumer complaint that we have from our customers is they don't know what their policy pays for. And what they've got to do to stay synchronized with the carrier so that the carrier pays. And all we're really trying to do is make the insured aware of two things: how to file the claim and what he's going to get. Now, I can't imagine anybody resisting that type of public relations disclosure effort.
I think the idea of disclosure is good, Tom. What I'm getting at is, one, is it possible to have a uniform statement? And I gather it's not, because you'd have different coverages by different companies with, you know, varying deductibles and so forth. But, and so I think that you couldn't have the insurance commissioner promulgate it, which was running through my mind initially.
Mm-hmm.
But turning it on its head, I mean, every policy is, of course, subject to legal interpretation, and what a court does or says the policy means may not be what the company that writes it thinks it says. How do we get some element of certainty in here so that when they make a disclosure form, they know that it's legally sufficient?
You know, I think as lawyers, we're always have that problem. State Farm did it in one little sheet about their claims adjusting policy. I would think the only person who might resist this type of disclosure would be someone who sells a gilded discount policy, because the claimant would then know, you know, what the cost was, and I think it is reducible to language of the insurer's choice. And it's got to be their choice, because there are policies written for stated values. There are policies written on actual cash value. I don't know if that's an adequate answer to your question, but I think it's a problem that can be addressed fairly easily.
In your judgment, Mr. Chairman, in your judgment, Tom, this kind of an explanation of policy would be adequate to what you have in mind on Section 5A.
Yes, sir.
Then Section 5, sub 1, Section 5 2A is what I meant. Section 5 sub 1 you would anticipate you could take care of that by advising them what the rights are over here in 3, 1, and 2, by an endorsement on the check or verbally.
Either or. The other thing is, I'd like to draw your attention to the language in subsection 2. It says that the policy shall be accompanied by a statement. That does not mean printed into the policy. We were trying to reduce the burden on the carriers to the absolute minimum so that they could use a brochure and something that the insured could carry in their glove compartment if they chose to do so. There are many carriers that now do that. That would satisfy, I think, the provisions of this section. A simple little glossy brochure with an accident report form printed right on the back of it, I think would be a sugar-coated way to address the problem.
Yeah. The members of the committee are going to have to recess for a while to go to the House floor, and I apologize to those of you who are here from the public. Today is an extremely important day in the House. We've got at least a half a dozen really major bills up that I think some of us are going to be wanting to take part in considering. It's my hope that we can resume consideration of this bill on our afternoon agenda. For those of you who can't stay around and come back, I realize some of you have businesses to return to and so forth. Obviously, the representatives of the different points of view are not going anywhere. And they will be here. Those of you who can stay and return, we certainly invite you to do so. I can't guarantee we will be able to take up the bill this afternoon. We do have other matters that are scheduled, but I believe we should. And we will certainly strive to complete final action on the committee, by the committee, whatever it winds up being, as quickly as possible. If that can be today, so much the better. In the meantime, that'll give also Mr. Wheatley and any of you who haven't had a chance to review the amendments, give you a chance to look those over in more depth and perhaps be prepared to respond further. The committee will be in recess till 1:30.